The following is a rebroadcast of Sioux Valley Voice, recorded on the morning of July 2, 2014, with guest Wayne Dyock. This recording of Sioux Valley Voice is also available online at ktna.org. The next Sioux Valley Voice will be on Wednesday, July 16th at 10 a.m. Good morning. You're listening to KTNA 88.9 FM Talkeetna. My name is Philip Manning, and this week on Sioux Valley Voice, my guest is Wayne Dyock, Project Manager for the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. We'll be discussing the current status of the project, community concerns, and taking your calls. The number to call if you want to join in on the conversation is 733-1200, or you can send an email to dj@ktna.org. Wayne Dyock, thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you, Philip. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, obviously, we were talking a little bit before the show began, and obviously, this is big time study season as the rivers are opened up. And talked last weekend, had a little bit of concern with high water, just like everybody else in the area. But where I want to start this morning is, I guess it's easy to imagine that everybody in the area knows about the project and what's going on and if completed, what it would look like and things like that. But there very well could be some folks who don't really have a picture of what the project really is. So if you could give me what they call the elevator pitch. You can give me the elevator synopsis of what Susitna-Watonna is.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. So, first of all, we're looking at a dam site that's around 184 miles up the river from the mouth. And we would be constructing a dam that's around 700 feet tall at that location. The goal would be to store water during the summertime, release a fair amount of water for the summer for fishery needs and boating and recreation needs. And then in the winter, the flows would be used to generate power. So you'd have pretty constant flows on a year-round basis.
Okay. And the maximum capacity is about 600 megawatts, is that right?
That's right. We would have three units, each of about 200 megawatts, to be able to generate a total capacity of 600 megawatts. The more important number, I think, though, is the amount of energy generation, and that would be around 2,800 gigawatt hours annually.
Okay, and how does that compare to, say, the Eklutna gas plant that they're building down there?
Well, I think the best way to compare it is how much energy do we use on an annual basis. We use around 5.2 million megawatt hours, and so this would be 2.8 million megawatts. So it would be about half of what we use in the rail belt area.
Okay, and so and that number, that 2.8 million megawatt hours, does that assume running at max capacity, or is that modeled for what's likely to actually happen?
That's what's likely to happen. It's okay. Based on the demand. We've run simulation models, taking the water over a 60-year period and running it through the simulation model for each of those years and looking at the demand that you have, and that's the amount of energy that you would get out of the system.
Okay. And so that's and the demand and the amount of water that's going to be necessary for fisheries and things like that, that's part of what's being studied right now, right?
Absolutely.
So, and to kind of get into that, you know, obviously, with a project that big, there's a lot of regulation and a lot of pre-work that needs to be done, and that's the phase that's happening right now. So, I imagine, again, a lot of people know that the FERC, or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is in charge of licensing these dam projects, and they require multiple years of studies in order to even apply for the license. Right?
That's correct. We're undertaking what's called an integrated licensing process, and that requires a minimum of 2 years of study. We're fortunate in that we have 5 years of intensive studies that were conducted in the 1980s, And before we even started the formal licensing process here, we had an additional year of study 3 years ago. And by virtue of how the product is being funded, we're going to end up with 4 years of study, actually.
Okay. And so when you talk about the studies that were done previously, both 3 years ago and then back in the 1980s, is that all still in line with because I know in the 80s they were looking at this project previously. So is that still in line with the sort of studies that FERC wants to see?
I believe it is, yes.
Okay. But they haven't definitively said one way or the other?
Well, what FERC has done is they issued a study plan determination in February and April of last year, and they specified that AEA would conduct 58 different studies.
Right.
And so we took what FERC requires and developed field programs to collect the information, and we'll be compiling that information, conducting an assessment, and then ultimately filing a license application at the end of 2016.
Okay. And so there's a couple things there that you talked about, the way that the project's being funded right now, and then the current timeline being applying for a license at the end of 2016. That's all had to change a little bit after this past budget session by the governor and the state legislature. So before the beginning or around the time that the governor's budget was announced initially last winter, the word from AEA was that there was $110 million needed roughly to complete all of the studies needed to go to licensing, basically. And at the time, there was an issue with land access to a lot of the Native Corporation-owned land in the area. And that prompted the governor to say, well, I'm not going to give you all of what you're asking for. He ended up going with $20 million and then later added a $32.7 million supplement. And at the end of the day, what ended up happening was $30 million through the legislature.
Yeah, well, actually, what it was when the governor announced his budget, it was $10
million. You're right, yeah.
And then there was a $32 million supplement. And at the end of the day, the legislature and the governor agreed upon a $20 million.
You're right. So, but I mean, that's then affected your timelines as far as the study plan and then ultimately the license application, right?
Absolutely. It's increased the study period and the date by which we can file the license application by 1 year.
Okay. So as far as that, and that's what's worked into when you talk about 4 years of studies, it's because that has to be stretched out?
That's correct.
So is there going to be additional, well, I guess before I get too far into that, let's talk about what's actually happening this year. Because last year there was, I want to say, $95 million on the table, something like that?
Right.
And so, you know, there were helicopters, there were boats, there were scientists all over the place in the Upper Valley last year, all working on studies for this project. This year, I've seen a few, but not nearly as many. So in the past, you've said that the focus this year is on priority studies, things that need contiguous years of data. Can you give us an encapsulation of what specific areas that means?
Sure. It primarily relates to the fisheries, water quality, and wildlife studies. So I'll talk about, you know, water quality. We have a number of what we call focus areas, and these are intensively studied areas. There are 10 of them upstream of the confluence of the Talkeetna, Chulitna, and Susitna, you know, rivers. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be collecting water quality data at those locations and then some additional water quality data to supplement what we collected, you know, last year. Probably the greatest effort, though, is in the fisheries work. We conducted a salmon escapement study, you know, last year in cooperation with the Department of Fish and Game. And we felt that was important to get, you know, 3 years of contiguous, you know, data, this being the third year of that study. And that's our big study that we're doing, you know, this year, where we have, you know, fish wheels in the vicinity of the confluence with the Yentna River. Fish and Game is operating those fish wheels and tagging a number of fish. And then we track the locations of those fish on a day-by-day basis. Then upstream at Curry, we have another set of fish wheels on either side of the river where one of our consultants is tagging the fish there, and then we monitor where they're going. So that's our big study. But we're also conducting, you know, studies in each of the focus areas so that we can better understand mm-hmm. the influence of the flows in the river and the water quality associated with the fish habitat. Okay. And then from a wildlife perspective, what we're doing is continuing the caribou, moose, and ptarmigan telemetry studies where we radio collared a number of those animals and we're monitoring their migration patterns and just their habits. And so okay. Fish and Game is out there, you know, fairly frequently, you know, doing that effort.
Okay. And so as part of this as well, and continuing kind of dovetailing the funding and what's happening this year, the initial study report, which was initially originally scheduled for February, had to be pushed to June because the funding meant that at that point you weren't quite sure what the 2014 study season was going to look like. That led to some pushback from a lot of the folks who are either concerned or outright opposed to the project, that their belief is that the initial study report and the feedback sessions to that are meant to inform the second year of studies. But we've got the second year of studies happening right now, and those meetings don't happen until closer to the fall. How does that interplay work?
Well, I would say that this year, it's not really what I would call the second year of studies. This is continuing those studies that were necessary and filling in some data gaps that we didn't get last year because we didn't have access to Alaska Native lands, some of the Alaska Native lands. So the FERC will come up with a study plan, I guess their second determination, at the end of January in 2015, and they will tell us what additional studies or what changes to the studies that go above and beyond what we're proposing for this year. And that was, you hit the nail on the head. That was one of the key reasons why we had to push the filing of the initial study report to June.
So this is not really the second year. It's not really year two studies. It's year one. Year one, part two, I guess, would be the way to put it.
Right.
Because when you were talking about those focus areas, my understanding is that either two or three of those focus areas you didn't have access to last year.
Correct. There were three focus areas that we did not have access to last year.
So, and that's so that's where a lot of the effort this year is then?
Well, I think we're also looking at the other seven, focus areas and collecting, data in those areas as well. It's all important, and it's information that can be used into the these complex models that we're developing.
Right. So, and I mean, when it comes to when you've got those 10 focus areas, now you're kind of playing catch up on the other three, which, if you don't have access, it's hard to study them. I get that. Now, when you come back next year in 2015, is there the possibility or is there concern that those other seven focus areas, when you are dealing with a river that moves and shifts and does a lot of things, that there could be significant changes in the seven areas that you weren't able to devote as much money to this year?
Well, there's always the possibility that you're going to have change in this river system. But what we have done is we've looked at the river today versus 30 years ago. We have from the data back in the 80s, and there really hasn't been a lot of change upstream of Talkeetna. There's a lot of stability in that reach of the river, but there has been some change. There has been more change, actually, downstream of Talkeetna. There's been some areas that have shifted a couple of hundred feet where it's really much more limited in change upstream.
Okay. You're listening to Sioux Valley Voice. My guest today is Wayne Dyock, project manager for the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. If you want to join in on the conversation, the number to call is 733-1200, or you can send us an email, dj@ktna.org. And actually, I put a post up on our Facebook page as well, so you can leave a comment there. We've been talking a lot about what's going to be happening this year and what's going to be happening going forward as far as the studies. And it's a big process. I mean, we're looking at, when all is said and done, when it's time to apply for a license, what's it going to look like in a dollar figure as far as end of 2016? What's that final dollar figure look like?
Well, we anticipate, based upon the studies that FERC has approved with the proposed modifications that we are recommending as part of our initial study report filing, a total cost for licensing of $287 million.
Okay. And then after that, assuming that the license is granted and all that, then you look at a pre-feed or a feed stage, which is front-end engineering and design.
That's correct. And the estimate for that is probably another couple hundred million. So we're looking at, by the time you're shovel ready, on the order of $530 million.
Okay. And is that the total cost for the project has been estimated? It's varied a little bit over time as things change, obviously, but over $5 billion.
That's correct.
And is this all included in that cost estimate?
Yes. Everything is included in that cost estimate.
Okay. With the exception of the transmission grid, because that's not part of the project, right?
Well, there's a part of the transmission line that is included, and the part that is included is linking up the project site with the intertie.
Okay.
There are additional intertie improvements that need to be made, and that's irrespective of Susitna-Wetana, though.
And that's where I was going to go with that, is we've heard a little bit about, you know, obviously people who live around here know that the grid is pretty fragile up here with the frequency of power outages and things. Anytime the wind kicks up or it starts to rain, it seems like the lights go out. And there's when I talked to Joe Griffith with MEA, the cost estimate, who's also heading up ArcTech, I believe, who's kind of pushing for this transmission line upgrade, they're talking about a cost of about $900 million. But you say that's they're pushing ahead of that regardless of Susitna-Wetana?
Yes, those improvements are needed in the system, and I'm not an expert on the transmission system here, but I will tell you from what I've learned from my colleagues is that those improvements, you know, need to be made to make sure we have a stable system. There are challenges with getting some power off the Kenai Peninsula, so there's a substantial amount of money that needs to be invested there. There are some improvements in the northern part of the transmission system between Anchorage and Fairbanks that need to be made as well.
Okay. So, and so if for whatever reason that weren't to happen, because that gets a lot less press, obviously, than the big projects like this and the gas line. If that weren't to happen, what would that mean for Susitna-Wetana?
Well, I think there has to be, you know, some level of, you know, transmission line improvement. I don't know that there's a way around that. There definitely have to be some upgrading of the intertie. When the intertie was originally envisioned, it was envisioned and developed to be operated at a higher voltage than what it's currently operated at now. So that's probably an easier modification that needs to be made. But you have to have a system, and I think that the utilities and the Alaska Energy Authority and the legislature will be working together on those transmission line improvements over the next couple of years. AEA completed a report, you know, recently that describes what those improvements, you know, should be made. So I would expect that there's going to be more information from that forthcoming over the next year.
Okay. And kind of continuing on the theme of looking ahead a little bit, obviously, as we learned this year, for sure, the pace of Susitna-Wetana and the way that it moves forward is very much dependent on both the administration and the state legislature. This year, I talked with a number of state legislators who were, I don't want to say necessarily unenthusiastic, but they weren't quite as gung-ho as they had been in years past. And that was specifically, in fairness, that was specifically about adding a supplement to the budget. Senator Mike Dunleavy, Representative Wes Keller, who both represent this area, were leery about adding a supplement to the 2014 budget. Both did ultimately vote for the $20 million that did get received this year. Do you see there being sufficient political will going forward, especially with the state being strapped for cash right now?
Well, that's really not a question that I can answer. I would just say, though, that we're going to be providing an updated, you know, feasibility report in the not-too-distant future that will feed into the information that our legislators have for moving the project forward. And we'll just have to monitor the situation.
Okay. because, I mean, in the midst, there is a big fiscal discussion going on right now down in Juneau, has been for the last year. And if the forecasts are correct, it'll continue for the next couple of years. So that's definitely something that I think everybody's watching, but I imagine you in particular.
Well, certainly. We will be providing our budget request, and then in December, the governor will announce his budget or her budget, and then at the legislature in the next session will work with the administration and determine what level of funding is appropriate.
And I guess that is something to mention as well. This is an election year. We're going to be voting for governor, lieutenant governor, a fair number of the senators, more than usual because of the way that the redistricting was drawn up, as well as all the state reps. So the political climate could change one way or the other in Juneau, I suppose.
Well, one thing I've experienced in my career is change. It always happens.
Right. Well, and I guess I should bring that up as well. This is not your first project.
No, it's not.
So could you give it a little bit of background on the hydro projects you've worked on in the past?
Sure. I've worked on projects throughout the United States, pretty much in, I think, 25 different states. I've worked on projects in Canada. I actually started off working on the James Bay project as a consultant for the Inuit. And I've also been working on projects in Africa. I was responsible for portions of a large hydro in Ghana, and I've worked on projects in China as well.
Okay, and so how does this measure up to some of those projects as far as scale?
Well, the James Bay project was certainly a larger scale than than this one, but I think this is a significant project, but it's certainly not the largest project by any means. There are 10 projects that are being constructed in the world today that are larger than Susitna-Wetana. Those are projects that are actually under construction.
And are those in North America or the United States?
Those projects are not in North America. They're elsewhere in the world.
Okay. Because I know that when you look at like things like the Three Gorges Dam, I think when anybody talks about big dams, a lot of people kind of go to Three Gorges and some of the issues that have happened there. I mean, can you offer some reassurance as to why this is different?
Well, Three Gorges is an enormous project in the sense that it required a lot of resettlement. But some of the things that people don't know are the number of fatalities that occurred due to flooding each year at Three Gorges. The number that I heard was on average as many as 20,000 people. And that's pretty significant. So I don't think that's comparable. I think you have to look at each hydro project as a unique project and understand its benefits and its effects and how those effects are mitigated to really make a decision on that project.
Okay. Well, we do have a caller on the line. Ellie has a question about alternative energy. Ellie, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Wayne. Thanks for coming up and being on the radio program here. My question relates to stepping back and looking at the bigger energy picture a little bit. A couple of years ago, AEA had a wonderful brochure that was describing other energy, alternative energy projects that were going on around the state, wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, et cetera. I've heard it said that the cost of Susitna Dam, for what that thing would cost, you'd almost be able to put a solar array on every house in the state of Alaska. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what's happening with these other energy sources, such as what was described in those brochures, why Susitna-Wetana would override those. It seemed like there were some pretty good projects going on. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Thanks. Sure, Ellie. That's a great question. So the Alaska Energy Authority is not just about Susitna-Wetana. We do look at other alternative energy, including wind. We've been working on a number of wind projects throughout the state. Solar is effective in the summer, not so much in the winter here, and we do need winter energy. But we're also looking at things like tidal power. So we're planning those activities. But we have a policy in the state that we would like to have 50% renewable energy by 2025. And to accomplish that, the Alaska Energy Authority, a couple of years ago, prepared what's called a decision document. And in that document, it concluded that the most feasible way to meet that goal was through a large hydropower project, and Susitna-Wetana was the preferred, you know, project.
So now that things are moving a little bit, looking more towards a gas pipeline, it seems like something like that could tide us over for the, I've heard, 15 or 20 year window for getting to some of these other projects that might be another way of doing things rather than building such a mega project that that definitely has some downsides to it.
Well, I'm not an expert on the amount of natural gas, but I can tell you that the state is working on the gas pipeline. But we look at the gas pipeline as something that's complementary to, you know, Susitna-Wetana. And so we're working on parallel paths with both projects at this time.
So, all right. Thanks for the call, Ellie. And that's actually that leads nicely into one of the areas I wanted to get into, which is talking about the gas pipeline. And I've heard both yourself and the AEA's executive director, Sarah Fisher-Goad, say basically the same thing, that you view Susitna-Wetana and the gas pipeline as complementary. But, you know, that kind of leads me back around to the question of money. You know, the state is now, under the current framework, provided that ConocoPhillips signs on, under the current framework, the state's going to be potentially putting a lot of money into the gas pipeline. So it sounds like this might be kind of an ideal scenario in your eyes, where you have both the pipeline and Susitna-Wetana, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of certainty in Juneau, especially about whether the money exists for both right now.
Well, I'm not the right person to ask that question to, but I would just offer that as we go forward with, you know, both projects, we need to, you know, keep evaluating our options, and that's what the state, you know, is
right,
looking at. The gas pipeline, from what I understand, is in the order of 50 to 60, you know, billion. We're about 10% of that.
Right. It is a significantly less expensive project, but as far as the state's expenditure, as a, 25-ish percent partner, depending on what share TransCanada ends up taking on, the state's investiture would still be higher than Susitna-Wetana. And actually, we've got another call coming in, so we'll get to that in a few minutes. But that's something else that's interesting is when you talk about a $5 billion project, Alaska loves mega projects. We've built a lot of them over the years. When you look at a price tag that big, obviously, you know, the state isn't terribly likely to just dip in and grab that money out of reserves necessarily. So what's the financing structure look like?
I think that's a good question as well. A lot of good questions here today. So we have not discounted any financing, you know, option. We're looking at all kinds of them. For the analysis that we've done to this point in time, you know, we're really not anticipating that the state is going to, you know, pay for this product. There's going to be some kind of, you know, funding, you know, structure. There are various mechanisms that are out there. One that was looked at in the 1980s and still looks good today is with the Rural Utility Services funding. So that's a potential that we're going to continue to look at. So what the state of Alaska is doing is putting up some of the upfront capital, but our analysis is actually predicated upon the state being repaid that upfront capital when you come to closure before you start construction.
And that's by making agreements with utility companies?
That's right. You would want to have a power purchase agreement with the utility companies. They're going to have to make sure that it meets their needs, but we've been working with them, and you know, they need to be replacing their aging infrastructure over time.
So, you know, when we're talking about that, and you, even if you are dealing with the rural, is there enough money in the rural utility project or your rural utility funds to do this?
Well, like I said, that's just one option. And when they have a representative up here in Alaska, we've spoken, you know, with their representative, and in some years, they have had a lot of money, billions, but I can't foretell what the future is going to be, so that's dependent upon Congress, actually.
Okay, so that's a variable number. It's not an entitlement or anything like that.
That's right, but it is a desirable program because they have not had any defaults with our U.S. funding, and so it actually does make money for the Treasury.
Okay. We do have another caller on the line. If you want to join in, the number is 733-1200 or 733-1205, since we do seem to be getting a couple more calls now. We've got Sharon on the line with a question about an ADA assessment. Go ahead, Sharon.
Hi, Wayne. Thank you for being online with us. I have grave concerns for the alignment of decision-making power in what is to be nearly $6 billion in a project. Let me explain what I'm saying.
We're having just a little bit of trouble hearing you, Sharon.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. What I am saying is AEA stands to greatly benefit from the positive assessment of this project, and yet AEA is funded to oversee a feasibility study, essentially a grand feasibility study for the potential of creating a project that will eventually be nearly $6 billion, the largest in Alaska's history. Okay, so my concern is the alignment of decision-making power. AEA is being paid to do this, to oversee this grand assessment, and yet in the end of the day, if the project is found to be positive and let's go, AEA stands to greatly benefit from that assessment.
Sharon, can you clarify what you mean by benefit there?
Well, a $6 billion project could cause a state agency to become much bigger than it already is. AEA stands to greatly benefit and have an enormous project in their hands to oversee and carry out over a whole bunch of years. So the bottom line is, how can it possibly be balanced? How is it not a glaring conflict of interest?
All right. Mr. Dyack?
So, Sharon, the way it works, we have a board at the Alaska Energy Authority that oversees things. Our mission is to provide low-cost power to people within the state of Alaska. That's our mission. Our mission isn't to grow AEA, quite frankly. And so we need to look at projects objectively. And there are going to be lots of folks that are overseeing what we're doing, including the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. There are also other agencies that are involved in the permitting process. We will need what's called a 404 permit from the Corps of Engineers, and so they'll be a part of this, you know, this process. So there's going to be lots of folks, and I would hope that the whole process ultimately will be considered transparent. And so we're not trying to just say, hey, let's build this thing. We're trying to put information out there to our board, to the administration, and to the legislators and the public so that they can see, and ultimately those are the decision makers, and FERC is the ultimate decision maker as far as whether we get a license.
Okay. We're just about to the bottom of the hour, so we're going to take a quick break here. If you want to join in on the conversation, the number to call is 733-1200 or 733-1205 if that line's busy. You can also send us an email, dj@ktna.org, or leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Sioux Valley Voice and my guest, Wayne Dyack. Okay, and we're back. This is Sioux Valley Voice. My name is Philip Manning. I'm your host for the rest of this hour. My guest today is Wayne Dyock, project manager for Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. The phone rang one more time, and it was actually I'd cut Sharon off the line there and didn't actually mean to. So, Sharon, did you have a follow up to your question?
Thank you, Philip. I was able to hear only part of Wayne's response, but essentially I understand the process. I know there are many agencies involved, and my concern is AEA speaks from a place of it being a done deal, and my huge desire is that AEA hold a balanced position of truly assessing, is this thing feasible? There are so many voiced concerns with the fact that AEA speaks as though and presents information as though it's a done deal. So with what appears to me a real conflict of interest, I am asking AEA to please hold the balanced position of being a true assessor.
All right. Thanks for the call, Sharon.
Thank you.
Wayne?
Well, we are trying to do our analysis in an objective way. There was a lot of study, a lot of effort put forth in the project in the 1980s, and we have two additional years of data. To this point in time, I have not seen anything that would cause me to say, hey, we have something that we can't mitigate here. So our goal is to move forward with the licensing process. We're collecting baseline information. We'll do an impact assessment. If there are effects, we will need to look at how we can mitigate those effects, and that would be what we would put forward. Our board will need to look at that information and make a decision. The administration will need to make a decision, and the legislature will need to make a decision. You can't have a project without effects. I don't care what kind of project that you're talking about. One of the advantages of Susitna-Watonna is we would reduce our air emissions by about 1.3 million tons per year. That's a pretty significant positive benefit. And we have not put that in economic terms, but that equates to approximately the emissions of half of the vehicles in the state of Alaska. So it's pretty formidable.
Right. And so one of the things you mentioned as well is the goal for renewable energy by 2025, and that large hydro was listed as basically determined to be the easiest way, the most efficient way from the state's point of view to get there. And that goal was established by the Palin administration, as I recall, and has kind of carried forward since then under Governor Parnell. One of the things, and I guess this is a good time to kind of get into this topic in the last 20 minutes or so here, is a lot of the folks, particularly around here, as we've heard over the last few calls, they don't see it that way. They don't see this large hydro project as being either they don't see the trade-off as worth it, or they don't see, there's a growing trend out there, especially among folks who are passionate about the environment, that large hydro is not necessarily renewable. And so before the show, you mentioned that FERC has actually approved another large project. Where does that tie in, that belief that large hydro is not a renewable energy source, tie in with the fact that it looks like it's still going forward as a viable source of power?
Yeah, let me first clarify. Mm-hmm. The decision that FERC made 2 weeks ago on a product in Southern California is what's called an off-stream product. It's a pump storage product. It's large in the sense of multi-billion dollars,
okay,
and large in the sense that it's over a substantial area, and there's a large transmission line associated with that. So, but I would say that renewable, I define renewable as something that essentially you propagate itself. And in this case, the fuel is water, and water keeps falling, and so it's a renewable. Hydro is renewable. There are artificial definitions in some cases on what is considered renewable, and a lot of times those are for convenience for determining certain renewable portfolio standards. But typically, it's not because people look at hydro as not renewable. And as far as large hydro projects are concerned, Canada has many large hydro projects that they're actively pursuing. British Columbia Hydro, BC Hydro has a large project on the Peace River. Manitoba Hydro has their Kiosk project, which is 695 megawatts on the Nelson River. And then there's a 1,200 megawatt project right behind that. Hydro-Quebec is looking at some very large projects. Okay. And then last December in Labrador, there was a multi-billion dollar project that was received its financing. It's in construction mode at this point.
Okay. So I guess part of where that comes down is the question of renewable in the literal sense that you're taking it, which is it keeps going, versus impactful, I guess, is really where the distinction is being made there. And that's where really everyone I talk to, everyone who stops me on the street, which happens quite frequently around here, they're talking about impact specifically to the salmon and things like that. And actually before we get into that, we do have another caller on the line. But actually, yeah, if you could just talk briefly about the distinction there, because I guess renewable may not be the right word, but impactful.
I think that is exactly the way we need to be looking at any project. There's an entity in the U.S. called the Low Impact Hydro Institute, and they certify low impact projects. And that's what we need to be looking at. Each project in and of itself needs to be evaluated. What are its benefits? What are its effects? And that, I think, is how each project should be looked at. So for Susitna-Wautana, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to look at what is the effect on the salmon, what is the effect on the caribou, what is the effect on the moose, what is the effect on eagles and any other critter, what's the effect on vegetation, what's the effect on the social lives of people.
Okay.
And do that kind of analysis, and that's where the decision should be based upon.
So the Low Impact Hydro Institute, where does that, this is the first I've heard of it, where does that, who heads that up? Where does that come from?
Well, it's essentially a lot of non-governmental organizations and others. They have a board of directors, and they have an executive director. It's not a very large entity, but they certify low impact hydros. And I look at those aspects of what constitutes a low impact. It's not necessarily based on size. It's based on the effects that you would have.
Okay. And actually, I've just gotten an email question that ties into that nicely. So I have a question on the line. I'll get to that in just a moment. The 1205 line is still open if anyone's calling 1205 and getting a busy signal. This question is from Diane. Says, dams that affect salmon runs have mitigation costs. This will be an annual expense to the people of Alaska. I would expect that at this time, this is an unknown cost. Can you give us an example of what other dams that affect salmon runs spend on mitigation each year?
Well, certainly, and I think what we have to do is be careful because we have to look at each case. On the Columbia River, I don't believe that's analogous. They spend an awful lot of money. They spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars annually on that whole system, but that's a very large system. You have other river systems, and let me give you one that's comparable in size, the Roanoke River in North Carolina. It's not really salmon, but it's an anadromous fish. There's American shad, striped bass that go mm-hmm. there, and that is... The way they manage that is they manage it for flows, and that's something that we're anticipating. We have estimated close to $300 million in capital costs that we would be anticipating for protection, mitigation, and enhancements. How much of that is going to be for salmon? We have to go through all the studies to understand. So we're really 2 years away from getting to the point where we can say, this should be the cost for that. Right now, you have an estimate, but until we finish the studies, we won't really know that. We have included in the engineering design, though, some features that we know are going to be required based on other projects. So, for example, we want to be able to manage for water temperatures so we can optimize the water temperature for the salmon. So we've designed shutters that allows us to take water from different strata in the reservoir to meet the downstream water temperature needs that the salmon have.
Okay. And you said that so there is there an estimate at this time? Or?
Well, yes, there's an estimate of around $300 million for protection mitigation enhancement costs that could go up, it could go down.
And that's part of the one-time construction, or?
No, that's, that's correct. That's the capital cost. And there will be a flow effect as well. And we are using as a surrogate the flows that they estimated in the 1980s, based upon the in-stream flow studies that were conducted then. We're obviously conducting some detailed studies, so we will have new numbers for that. Okay. And then what that will, it's not so much a cost as much as how it might affect the energy, which is very important.
Okay. We do still have our caller on the line. Randall has a question about concrete. Go ahead, Randall.
Yeah, I heard on Science Friday about nickel cadmium or fiberglass used reinforced concrete, which would really lengthen the time span of the structure versus, regular rebar, which is the weak link, I guess, in a lot of concrete structures.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So, I mean, what are you looking at as far as building materials then?
Well, we're looking at what's called an RCC dam. So it's a placement of concrete which you don't need to have for, like, there's certain aspects will be traditional, concrete, but and you'll need rebar there. But for roller compacted concrete, that's the RCC, it's just a placement method. You don't put rebar. You just basically pour concrete and you put it, you compact it in place, and you use steps of several feet, and you just keep building and building until you get to the top.
Okay. So that's and is that a fairly common method right now?
Yeah, the RCC dams are being used in dams throughout the world, even very very large dams, bigger than Susitna-Wetana, and it's a placement method that came into vogue maybe 30 years ago, and it's being used more and more.
Okay, so thank you for that comment, Randall. That's I also enjoy Science Friday, and actually I think I remember hearing about that. So thanks for your call. As we're looking forward, one of the things we've been talking a little bit about impacts and where there's a lot of concern locally. And one of the things that it came up, especially at the last meeting, toward the beginning of last month, we had a big public meeting at the Upper Susitna Senior Center. A lot of folks turned up, all of them who spoke at least were opposed to the project. And really, one of the things that came up as a consistent theme is an issue of trust. And that kind of got touched on by a previous caller earlier, that there's a lot of people out there who see AEA as, not to put too fine a point on it, but a cheerleading organization. In their minds, that's what they're seeing. And so, when you do have some very nice, materials that get handed out, brochures, things like that, water bottles, which were absent from the Talkeetna meeting, I noticed. But where do you make that distinction? Because obviously to get funding from the legislators, you have to show them that this is a potentially viable project. But at the same time, you do have a responsibility for objectivity. Where does that compromise, where does that come in?
Well, I hope that we're objective in things we do. I tell all of my staff working on the product and the consultants that I don't want anybody fabricating anything. I want real numbers. I want substantiated. I want numbers that can be quality assured, quality controlled, and to present information, the way it is. Don't try to sugarcoat it. Let's get, good information. So objectivity is important. We also have a responsibility to get information out to the public, as I'm doing. I think it's fair to say that AEA considers hydro to be renewable. So we use renewable. Yes, Susitna would last for hundreds of years, quite frankly. If you maintain hydro products, there's no reason that it does that they wouldn't last for hundreds of years. There are projects that are in their second century that are continuing to be operational. So we have to get information, you know, out to the public. I think we're trying to do it objectively. And you're right, we have to get the information to the administration, to our board, and to the legislatures. And I don't look at it as salesmanship. I look at it as getting information out there. But I can see, you know, folks are looking at it and saying, gee, you got this glossy document. We're not trying to, you know, believe me, we don't spend very much money on that at all. Our money is really spent on getting the science, both for the environmental and for the engineering.
And I guess to go back to at that same meeting, one of the other things that came up, a specific graphic that's come up a few times, is this the measurement or the tracking of salmon at various points, so specifically kings, at various points up the Susitna River. And the graphic is illustrated in such a way that on it, you know, each fish is representative of however many, but on the graphic it shows up past Devil's Canyon and then up to the dam site, the number very sharp, or the graphic very sharply tapers off as far as the number of salmon, and people have taken exception to that. Where, as far as the presentation of that information goes, I mean, are there thoughts toward changing how that's looked at right now?
Well, let me say that the numbers accurately reflect what the fish that we tagged. But let me put it in another way, because for the first time ever through these studies, we actually have population numbers for salmon, at least for last year. And we didn't have good numbers for the number of, you know, and when I say salmon, I think mainly I'm dealing with, you know, Chinook salmon here, because those are the only, you know, species that make it upstream of Devil's Canyon. But we had approximately 90,000 Chinook salmon that are greater than, you know, 50, you know, centimeters, make it upstream of our fish wheels that are at the Yentna River confluence. So they're just upstream of that. So we know that there were 89,000 Chinook salmon, larger Chinook salmon, that moved upstream in the Susitna River above the Yentna. We also know, based on the studies that we did, that at Curry, which is at around river mile 120, there were something like 7,000 large Chinook salmon that made it upstream of there. And then the number that I think people really object to is how many fish made it upstream of Devil's Canyon. So the actual number of fish that made it upstream of Devil's Canyon is somewhere between 60 and 80 fish, all right, Chinook salmon. And out of those, most of those fish actually spawned downstream of where the dam site is. So it was between Devil's Canyon and the dam site. So we know that there were somewhere between, let's say, 5 and 30 fish, most likely, that spawned upstream of the Watana dam site. And the numbers show probably more like 10 to 15, but I'm giving a larger bound. But we are pretty confident that the number of fish that made it upstream of Devil's Canyon were between 60 and 80.
Okay, 60 and 80. Okay. We have a caller on the line, and we've got a couple of email questions and not a whole lot of time. So let me go ahead and get to a couple of these. We've got two from Brian. I'm going to pick one of these here. The first one that came in here says, since there's no power purchasing agreements yet with electric companies to purchase power produced by the proposed Susitna Dam, and the total cost of constructing the dam will be an unknown until it's completed, how will the consumer be guaranteed that electricity will be cheaper in the future, as AEA is, he says, advertising here? And there is a graph in y'all's literature.
Well, that's right. And what we're looking at is affordable power. And over a 50-year period, the average cost of power is around, you know, 7 cents a kilowatt hour. And there's something to be said for hydro. It's very stable cost. Once you get a project constructed, you know your costs aren't going to change, because 90-some-odd percent, actually probably 95-plus percent of your costs are those fixed costs. And once the product is paid for, then the costs drop down considerably. So this project would last well beyond that. But for 50 years, we're saying that the average cost is going to be around 7 cents. And it's the financing mechanisms that we're going to be looking at will dictate the specific, you know, cost of power. So there's different combinations of that. So I would say that we have to work that aspect out over time.
And, I mean, that's also going to be dependent on, as far as being cheaper than all other sources, though, that's also going to be dependent on things like the gas line, though.
Absolutely. And we have, you know, done some analyses, and we're clearly going to be doing, you know, more analyses on what is the cost of alternative generation using natural gas. And we, in the graphic that you're referring to, Philip, we looked at a lower gas price forecast. We looked at what we thought was a most likely forecast, and then what a high forecast would be. The high forecast is really the amount of money that you could get for the gas if you were to export it. Mm. So if you exported it, you could get, you know, dollars a million BTU. So our numbers are based on $6.50 per million cubic feet, or per MCF, for million BTUs, I guess it is, mm-hmm. per million BTUs. And it's escalated at 4% with inflation at around 3%. So it's okay. About a 1%. And we're also looking at those numbers on a daily basis and seeing, are they changing? And we will be looking at updating that.
So there is a lot of variability, though, potentially, when you're talking about variable costs, because sometimes projects run over cost, sometimes they run under cost. But there is a lot of variability. It also depends on how it ends up being financed and the cost of gas. So there's a lot of variables, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And that's the cost of the project,
right.
And cost overruns is something that we're looking at very closely as well.
Okay.
How do you best manage them?
All right. We do have one more caller that I want to get to, because it's a question that comes up a lot. And it's Greta with a question about location near a fault line. Go ahead, Greta.
Yes. In your experience all over the world with these dam projects, have any of them been located as near a major fault line as the proposed dam here is? I'd be interested in your answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Greta.
Thank you, Greta. Good question. You know, seismic interests are very important to Alaska Energy Authority, as well as to FERC. My expertise is not seismicity, but we have some experts that we're working with that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission feels are, you know, some of the top-notch scientists in the world. And there are major projects that have been built much closer to larger fault lines. As a matter of fact, there was a large project in China that had an earthquake very close to the dam site, and it was a concrete dam, and it had very little damage associated with it. I think it was only a couple of kilometers away. Here, the Denali Fault is on the order of 50 miles or so, but we have been doing a tremendous number of studies, and that's actually not the driver for the design. It's a different type of what's called a subduction, seismic event that will be, dictating what our design is, and so we're designing for that. But we are going to continue to do work in that area, and if you look at our seismic report that we produced as part of the initial study report, there's some very good information, because we're monitoring a lot of earthquakes, mm-hmm. and we've actually monitored over 1,500 earthquakes, and we're looking at how this project would be affected by earthquakes and coming up with a design that's going to meet some very stringent safety standards that we have today.
Okay. We did have one other call come in. I don't think we've got time to take it, though. We're just about out of time. One last thing. I mean, obviously, it's become pretty apparent that anytime you come up here, you're definitely in line. People line up to ask a lot of tough questions about this project. Do you think, and briefly, is there any way, do you see bringing the people here who do live closest to this project, do you see a way to bring folks around? Or, I mean, is there anything that would convince them? And is what would convince you all on the other side that it's not viable in about 30 seconds?
Well, I think we need to keep the dialogue open. We've actually opened an office up here in Talkeetna that we're staffing Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Please come and see us. We are very interested in working with you, trying to understand and trying to get information back out to you. So I hope it's not a question of you convince me or me convince you, that we work together and look at the issues and come up with a solution.
Okay. Thank you. My guest today has been Wayne Dyock. That's about all the time we've got. If you missed any of our conversation with Wayne Dyock, project manager for Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project, or if you'd like to listen again, we'll be rebroadcasting Sioux Valley Voice at 7 o'clock tonight, or you can listen online anytime at ktna.org. My name is Philip Manning. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.